Pull up a chair. I want you to close your eyes for a second if you're not flying the airplane or driving the car, and picture a ramp at Idlewild in 1949. It's evening, the lights going gold and long across the concrete. And sitting there nose high, tail feathers stacked up in three fins against that sky, is the prettiest thing anybody in aviation ever bolted together out of aluminum. That's a Connie, and that's where we're spending the next little while. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, where we don't just tell you what an airplane did. We try to put you in the cockpit, in the smell of it, in the noise of it. Today we're talking about the Lockheed Constellation, the Connie, and I'll be honest with you right up front, I'm a little biased on this one, because I've stood next to a restored Connie on a hot ramp, and there is nothing, nothing, in the whole history of the airlines that looks like her. Now, before we roll the wheels on this story, let me tell you who's buying the coffee this morning. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, your first solo, your private, that instrument rating you sweated through in actual, in the soup, holding heading and altitude while your instructor sat there like a sphinx. There's a coin for all of it. Every coin tells a story, same as every airplane does. If you've earned it, they've got it. AviationSoul.com. Go take a look. All right, let's get into it. Here's the thing you have to understand about the Constellation. She didn't start out as an airliner for you and me. She started as a secret. Roll the clock back to 1939. The airline business is crawling along on airplanes like the Douglas DC-3. And don't get me wrong, I love the Goonie Bird. We've talked about her before. She's a saint, but she's slow. She's unpressurized. She flies down in the weather, where it's bumpy and it's cold and everybody's reaching for the little paper bag. Cross the country in a DC-3, and you're stopping to refuel more times than you can count on both hands, and you're doing it overnight, and you arrive feeling like you've been beaten with a sack of oranges. Enter a man named Howard Hughes. Now Hughes at this point owns a controlling piece of Transworld Airlines, TWA. And Hughes is a lot of things, some of them not so flattering, but the man could fly. And the man had vision, and the man had money, and he walks into Lockheed out in Burbank, California. And he wants an airplane that nobody else has. He wants it fast. He wants it pressurized so it can climb up over the weather instead of bouncing through it. And he wants it to fly coast to coast nonstop, which in 1939 is science fiction. And here's where it gets interesting. Hughes wanted the whole thing done in secret. The engineers working on it, the story goes, weren't even supposed to talk about who the customer was. This was going to be TWA's private weapon, a machine so far ahead of the competition that American and United and the rest would be left standing on the ramp, watching the taillights. So Lockheed puts their people on it, and one of those people, the one whose fingerprints are all over the airplane, is a young engineer who's going to become the most famous airplane man in America. Kelly Johnson, you know that name. Kelly Johnson is the fellow who later runs the Skunk Works. He gives us the P-38 Lightning. He gives us the U-2. He gives us the SR-71 Blackbird, which we've talked about on this show, the airplane that outran missiles that Kelly Johnson, and before all of that, he's sitting at a drafting table shaping the Constellation. And Johnson does something to this airplane that most engineers wouldn't have the nerve to do. He gives her a curved fuselage. Look at a Connie sometime. The body of that airplane isn't a straight tube like a modern jet. It bends, the belly dips and the nose comes up, and the whole line of her flows like a dolphin. There's a reason for it. It's got to do with keeping the cabin floor level and fitting the pressure vessel to the loads. But the effect of it, the look of it, is that she's got a shape like a living thing. Nobody builds them like that anymore. Nobody has the guts. And the manufacturing's gotten too clever for it. And then there's the tail, three fins. Now why three tails? Practical reason. And it's a good one. That airplane was so tall, if Lockheed had put one single vertical fin on her big enough to do the job, she wouldn't have fit in the airline hangars of the day. The tail would have been up in the rafters. So Johnson and his crew split the job across three shorter fins instead of one tall one function first. But the result, the look of that triple tail against a sunset, that's the kind of accident of engineering that turns a machine into a legend. Form followed function, and then function handed you something beautiful for free. Let me paint you the airplane herself for a minute, because the numbers matter. She's got four engines out on those wings. And not just any engines. Wright R3350, duplex cyclones, 18 cylinders each, two rows of nine, big radial power plants that on a cold morning cough and belch a little smoke, and then settle into that deep, uneven, chugging rumble that anybody who grew up around round engines can feel in their chest. You don't hear a radial, you feel it. It comes up through your boots. Four of those out front and later models are pushing better than 3,000 horsepower aside. That's 12,000 horsepower plus hauling her along, and she is fast. The early Constellation is doing better than 330 miles an hour up high. In the middle 1940s, that is quicker than a lot of the fighters that fought the war. A civilian airliner, and she'll run away from warplanes. Now here's the part that always gets me. Hughes and TWA had this airplane on order, and then the world caught fire. December of 1941, we're in the war, and the whole Constellation program gets swept up by the military before the airlines ever get to touch her. She goes to war as the C-69. The Army takes those first airframes, paints them olive drab, and the fast pressurized luxury liner Howard Hughes ordered in secret spends her first years hauling troops and cargo. And there's a story here, and I love this story. 1944. Hughes and a TWA president named Jack Fry, they take one of these airplanes, and they fly it across the country. Burbank, California, to Washington, D.C., and they do it in under 7 hours. Under 7 hours coast to coast, back when the fast way across America was a couple of days of hopping DC-3s through the weather. And they didn't paint it olive drab for the trip. The story goes they ran it in TWA colors for the publicity. Hughes wanted the country to see what was coming. He'd been sitting on this secret machine, the war had taken her away from him, and he wasn't going to wait a minute longer than he had to show the world. Under 7 hours. People couldn't believe it. Then the war ends, and now, finally, the Connie gets to do the job she was born for. 1945, 1946, the Constellation goes into airline service and pull up a chair, because this is the moment the whole way America travels changes. Before the Connie, crossing the ocean was a thing you did on a boat over several days or on a flying boat that put down on the water and needed calm seas and good luck. The Constellation, with her pressurized cabin and her range and her speed, she made the North Atlantic an airplane trip. New York to Paris, New York to London. Later they stretch her, they hang bigger tanks on her, they build the Super Constellation, and then the Starliner, and that airplane will fly you clear across the Atlantic nonstop against the winter winds, which nobody had done reliably on a schedule before. Now let me tell you what it was actually like inside, because this is where the Connie earns her halo. You climb the air stairs, and the first thing that hits you is that she's quiet. Not jet quiet, nothing's jet quiet yet, but compared to what came before, the pressurization and the insulation mean you're not being hammered by engine noise and you're not freezing and you're not gasping at altitude. You're up at 20,000 feet, over the weather, in smooth air, in shirt sleeves. The seats are wide. On some of the TWA airplanes, they'd convert them into berths, actual sleeping bunks, so you'd cross the ocean lying down. There were lounges, there was a galley turning out real meals on real china, hot food, because the airlines were competing on comfort and the Connie gave them room to do it. The cabin smells like coffee and cigarettes because everybody smoked back then, and warm food, and that particular smell of an airplane interior, and underneath it all that faint tang of hydraulic fluid and avgas that anybody who works around airplanes knows and secretly loves. And out the window, those three tails and the long curved back of her and four big radials turning, throwing blue flame at night out the exhaust stacks. Passengers used to watch those flames dancing on the cowlings in the dark and think they were on fire. They weren't. That's just what a big round engine does at night. That's the airplane breathing? This was the airplane of the movie stars and the diplomats and the presidents. This was, for a stretch of about 10 years, the way you crossed the world, if you crossed it in style. Now, I'd be a liar and a bad host if I told you she was a perfect airplane. She wasn't. Those beautiful, powerful Wright 3350 engines, they ran hot and they ran hard, and they were, let's be honest, temperamental. Mechanics of that era had a nickname for the Constellation, they called her. And forgive me, the best three-engine airliner in the sky. Because the joke, the sad true joke, was that she so often landed with one of the four shut down. Those engines would swallow a valve or throw oil or catch fire, and the flight engineer. And she had a flight engineer, a third man in the cockpit whose whole job was nursing those four temperamental radials. That fella earned every dime. There's a lot of hangar wisdom baked into that airplane. The Constellation is right at the far edge of what you can do with pistons. She's the top of the mountain for propeller airliners. She is as fast and as far and as high as a big radial engine airliner is ever going to go. Because right behind her, right on her heels, comes the jet, the Boeing 707, the Douglas DC-8. And once those come along in the late 1950s, the Connie's day is done, just like that. The jet is faster, smoother, and those turbines don't quit the way the big rounds did. So she had a short reign, maybe a dozen good years as the queen. And then the airlines put her out to pasture, and a lot of these gorgeous airplanes went to the desert and got chopped up for scrap, or ended their days hauling freight and cattle and sardines and whatever else needed, moving on the cheap run ragged by little outfits until the parts ran out. And that right there is the part that gets an old pilot in the chest. Because here's the payoff. Out of all the constellations that ever flew, only a handful are left in the whole world that are anything close to flyable, a tiny number, and keeping even one of them in the air is an act of pure, stubborn love. Those engines are hard to feed now. The knowledge of how to run a fleet of big Wright radials that walked out the door with a generation of mechanics who are mostly gone. Every hour one of these airplanes flies is somebody's whole heart and somebody's whole bank account poured into keeping a piece of that golden light on the ramp evening alive. There are people right now, volunteers, restoration crews, museums, who are pouring years into bringing Connies back, turning wrenches on engines older than they are, chasing down parts that haven't been made since before I soloed, doing it because when that triple tail rolls out of the hangar into the sun, and four radials light off one at a time with that cough and that blue smoke and that deep uneven chug, grown men and women stand there on the ramp and they go quiet, and some of them tear up. I've seen it, I've done it. Because that airplane is the sound and the shape of the moment. America decided the whole world was close enough to fly to. Back when the airlines were young and the future was a curved aluminum fuselage with three fins on the back and four fires out on the wings. If you want to read more about her, go find the histories of Lockheed and of TWA, the folks who've documented Kelly Johnson's work and Howard Hughes's airplanes. And better yet, go find a museum that's got a constellation and stand next to her. The people at those museums and the volunteer crews keeping the last flyers alive will talk your ear off, and you should let them. You can find us over at radiohanger.com if you want to holler at me about it. I'm Taildragger. Next time you see one of those triple tails in a photo or a museum, or if you're the luckiest pilot alive, taxiing in out of the evening light, you tip your hat to her. She was the most beautiful thing we ever built, and we'll never build one like her again. Fly safe. Keep the greasy side down.